Glad to now have some time for audience interaction. We'd like to take questions. We've got a microphone right here, but first I have some questions for you. And with this first question, I'd like everyone to stand up who lives in a neighborhood where it's safe to walk at 10 at night. Okay, and then I'd like you to keep standing. Those of you who are sitting now, where if you live in a place where you can find a swimming pool to for youth to swim in that don't have a pool in their own backyard, please stand up. Okay, those of you that are standing up that don't have a youth swimming pool, please sit down. Okay, in a place where you can find fresh produce near your neighborhood, I want you to please stand up. Everyone who has fresh produce within walking distance of your home. Okay, and then all of you that have to drive more than 40 minutes to work, and you have to drive a car, excuse me, those of you that have to drive a car to work, please stand up. If you don't have to drive a car to work, sit down. Okay. So it's either way. Okay. Okay, these are some of the, thank you. These are some of the environmental factors that people are dealing with in communities where we live, work, play. This is what we're talking about, environmental change. These are all factors that make a difference in whether you can be physically active or get sufficient nutrition. And in fact, in most of the communities where we work, if we took our audiences, most of the people would not have been able to stand up. They could not admit to having a safe place to walk at night, perhaps not even during the daytime, do not have adequate access to fresh fruit and vegetables within walking distance, have to depend on cars for going to work for hours at a time and are therefore not home to supervise children. They work long hours and low wages for the most part. All of these environmental factors conspire against people for healthier behavior and being able to have good nutrition and physical activity. And they're all amenable to change through system and policy change. And that's what our programs are devoted to doing, and we're finding success in doing that kind of change. So that's what these programs are about. Sir, your first question.
Thank you. First of all, great set of presentations, and I want to just ask, are there any that will not be available on the online service? So they're all going to be up there and available?
Right. You're unsure?
I'm unsure.
Well,
okay.
Two of our, but we can post it on the website.
We'll post it on the websites for each of the organizations. We'll make sure that they're available. There are none that are blocked to
Thank you.
I'm
David Walling. I'm a physician with the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. And your model is really interesting, and for the most part, I think it focuses on community demand and meeting demand for healthy foods and sort of creating environments for that. I want to ask a question about supply. Informed people who look at the farmers that we're going to expect in the future to supply fruits and vegetables are rapidly disappearing. And the Leopold Center estimates that within 10 years, we may have no moderate scale farmers able to produce produce at a scale sufficient to supply schools. So long term, my question to you is, long term, can we have a model for creating these healthy food environments in our communities if we don't have farmers to supply those foods? Thank you.
I have a question.
Then you have an answer.
Sure. One of the partners that's been working in the Central Coast is an organization called ALBA, and what they've actually been doing is helping to increase the number of farmers, taking farm laborers to actually develop their own farming. And in that way, these are the skilled residents who have the capacity, who have the knowledge, but haven't had the resources to get into their own business. And so we're hoping that that model will translate in the Central Valley, given that we have the same sort of assets, the land, and the resource. We just need to build our capacity to do that.
Another innovative model is Valley Vision. You can Google them. They're in the Sacramento region. They're creating regional food systems, creating a buffer zone around the Sacramento metropolitan area of farms, small farms, organic farms, to feed into the Sacramento region so food doesn't need to be imported, and sustaining those farms for sustainable farming. So they're creating markets and having the advocates make sure that those markets are well attended. That the buffer zone actually creates an area where you can't build new suburbs and new housing out there because it's viable farmland. Because right now,
small farmers market scale farms, that's a growing segment, the under 100 acres. I think the bigger challenge are the farms that are both sustainable but at a scale sufficient to supply a school or a Kaiser Permanente, for example. So I think that's going to be the real challenge for these models.
Right, and some of our organic farmers too work by subscription, where people subscribe to a box of organic fruit and vegetables, and they're able to get a number of subscribers together and sustain themselves because they can depend on their output for each time.
Just one small thing to add is that we're funding a variety of models that are being tested with farms. I can't speak in detail about them, but I also can say that we're now serving organic food in our hospitals, and with that comes relationships with farmers and using our purchasing power and all of that, so that we are helping to support local organic farming in that way through our hospital.
Yes, next question.
I just wanted to add that two things. One, that with the Oakland produce stands, they actually did work with creating a local farm just outside of Oakland and using community residents to work in the farm and to bring the produce in. The other thing is I think to also broaden this conversation about the impact of these strategies on food industry. And, you know, with the whole, all of the school strategies to change what's being offered in the schools, we have seen a response from industry where they have modified their products. But I think, and there was a great session yesterday where we presented some of our HEAC school data findings and studies that we've done in partnership with UC Berkeley on school nutrition policies in California. But what's now being offered is just a modest improvement. So I think really one of the big strategies that needs to be undertaken is how to get food industry to really provide whole foods and truly healthy choices to schools.
Next question here.
I think this question is from Pamela. In your data, you were showing where you had asked children or youth about access to healthy foods in their neighborhood. I was just curious, did you let them define what healthy food was, or did you define it for them? And if so, how did you define healthy food?
This is actually a question for Wendy.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, it was my data, but she collected it.
Yeah, so it lets them define it however they would define it. The question is, do you feel like you have access to, we asked about fresh fruits and vegetables and then to healthy snacks. And so we just use the word healthy and let them understand it how they might.
Next question.
Thank you. My name is Kit Kell. I work with the Association of Pedestrian and Bicycle Professionals. And it's really quite a thrilling time to think about active transportation right now with the opportunity with the CDC grants to put prevention to work. And I wanted just to bring to everyone's attention that there's a list that we have at our booth of potential active transportation modes that can be included in that program. And the good news is that we expect within the next 1 to 4 years, with the help of public health, there could be an active transportation legislation that will move through communities, or through commerce, so that communities will actually have money to do the infrastructure planning and infrastructure work. So my question for all of you, because it seems that we're at a point where we're at a perfect storm of emerging trends, as Richard Liu says in his comments about children and nature. To what extent are you working with some of the other fields that are also pushing children into a different lifestyle?
the transportation movement that you're talking about and the community putting prevention to work initiative is something that we're engaged in through our convergence partnership, both at the regional level and at the national level. So the California Convergence is working with the State Department of Public Health, health officers, health departments throughout the state to prepare them to make better applications, stronger applications, including these kinds of environmental change models. And our national convergence is really aiming at the transportation bill next year and helping us to have a better argument for why money needs to be directed at these kinds of community level programs that can make a difference in walkability, complete streets, school, safe routes to school, and those sorts of elements in the transportation bill and transportation funding so that communities can do that. And then, of course, with the ARRA funding, if that materializes, could be dedicated for these kinds of environmental change programs. Any others wish to answer? I think we're connecting very, very well to built environment changes, and we found actually one of the greatest lessons that we're finding out of this community-based work are that cities, local governments have been wonderful partners and have been very, very willing to partner for health. I don't think it had been really recognized how ready and willing they've been. Planning agencies that have not had an expertise at reaching communities and talking to communities generally held open meetings, and whoever showed up were developers and architects, but now they're starting to get real community people showing up saying, we care about our neighborhoods, we care about what you develop. And we're helping put those community people in the seats at those hearings to give voice to that. So I think this is the burgeoning area for where we're going and finding a very, very receptive civic leadership. And we're pleased to see that. Yes.
Hi, my name is Chris Cable. I'm with the Northwest Health Foundation in Portland, Oregon. And first, I wanted to say thank you to George Flores, who was incredibly generous with his time and insight in helping us to design our grant-making initiative several years ago that in many ways was modeled after DEAC. And we're seeing a lot of the same results, finding a lot of the same things, but my question is for Dr. Samuels, and in particular, with your evaluation, what you've been able to capture with regards to the quality of the multi-sector collaborations that have been funded. What we found, and I'm sure what others have found as well, is that there's some variability among the regions, the place-based collaboratives that we have certainly funded in terms of the depth and the continuity and the effectiveness of those multi-sector collaborations, and if you've identified any factors that have predicted the efficacy or the sustainability of those collaborations. Thank you.
Well, one of the things that I think has really we found to be very important is the fact that these communities are working across sectors so that there's sort of uneven development in each one of the sectors. And also there are uneven relationships. So sometimes, you know, the schools are very engaged, or sometimes there are neighborhood and community organizations that are engaged, or it may take more time to build those relationships, but in the meantime, the schools are really taking off. So some of the other activities in the other arenas. So I think the multi-sector approach, you know, doesn't assume that everything is going to be simultaneously effective at the same time, but it really allows for some synergy and some capturing that kind of, taking advantage of that uneven development.
And I'd like to just say a word about the collaborative approach, that collaborations take time to build, and I know across the six HEAC sites, the sectors that collaborated well in the past, we were able to build on that. The sectors that were new to the collaborative, in a lot of cases it was the schools, it takes time to build those relationships. Another key factor is finding the right champion within those institutions. Sometimes the person we started with didn't have the right influence, and it took a while to find somebody who was influential within the institution to get engaged in this effort in a strong enough way to really create that institutional collaboration. So the bottom line with that is that collaboration, as Sarah said, it's about relationships with real people. And if the people change, in some ways you almost have to start all over again. So it's finding the ways to build that and allowing time for that to strengthen.
I would echo, and I would also, you know, we have 40 sites and 40 collaboratives, and not all of them are successful. And, you know, in one of my slides about challenges, it was about if you can find an existing collaborative, do that. But we've tried to create collaboratives. It's taken years to get any action in place, and in some places we don't have any action even after lots of effort and turnover. And sometimes we don't have lead agencies. We have to create that, and it's really hard when you're starting from scratch.
Next question, sir.
Yeah, for those of us who are going back...
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Sorry, Mike Kennedy from Charlotte, North Carolina. For those of us who are going back to put together this ARRA grant by the December 1st deadline, with a two-year calendar, because it is to be considered one-year funding, I would ask what your thoughts were if you were going to pick your top three policy and environmental changes, what you'd go for with what the funding constraints are on that grant.
We did that in California, as a matter of fact, and picked our top three priorities. One is health in all policies, and that's kind of an overarching goal because it does apply so well to the built environment work and underlying factors. Another one is the sweetened beverage environment and reducing consumption of sweetened beverages. A third one has to do with access to schools after hours and joint use of schools, so to speak, so that communities that are without adequate play places can do that. And the fourth one, or third one?
Healthy food retail, there's a variety of strategies engaged in that. One of the other policy arenas is looking at increasing access to healthy foods, and there's a host of strategies that could go with it, including farmers markets, electronic benefit transfer, UBT, WIC access, corner stores. But I think the policy goals are all aimed at increasing access to healthy foods.
I'd also add sort of building on and taking advantage of existing policies where there's momentum. So schools, there's a lot of momentum across the country right now around school policies. I think the government worksite vending policies, that's an easy win to get a state to adopt policies, to get local government to adopt policies, to change the environment. I think also, you know, with the rollout of the WIC food package, there's real opportunity to use that to leverage changes in the retail environment. I think there are some opportunities around physical activity, you know, getting economic development funds in to improve parks and neighborhood built environment.
Yes.
I'm Greg Galestro of New York City, the FGE Food and Nutrition Team. I want to reference back to David's comment, somewhat question about this issue about what some of us call ag in the middle. It actually is an issue in the Northeast. I recognize this is in California, where you may be dealing with really the two extremes, the smaller farm and the very, very large farm. But, and maybe some consideration for the rest of us in the audience, that what this is. But have you found this discussion around ag in the middle as part of your conversation in California? And if so, do you perceive it as an issue that some of us are perceiving around the country with the farm to school relationships or the healthy food relationships?
Go ahead, Beth.
You know, because it's a strength of our region, we've had to look at how we're sort of just the paradox that we're growing all the fruits and vegetables and they're getting trucked out and they're being trucked in at a higher cost, and that there aren't these connections. And when we began these dialogue about why the connections aren't there, it is hampered by policies that even the small farmers cannot sell directly to the small store because of standardization laws of the produce and things like that. So I think it's an area that's ripe for intervention and policy and system change so that we can grow that capacity and make more of those needs. When you think about, you know, all the service within county facilities, the hospitals, the school districts, all of these places are places that should be benefiting from those relationships. And in our region that we've been growing fruits and vegetables, you know, for a very long time, it's not there.
And this one last question, but then we're going to have to leave because there's several of us in the panel that are due elsewhere.
Hi, I'm Linda Tracy from the Association of Pedestrian and Bicycle Professionals, and I work with the National Complete Streets Coalition, and I do have a question for you, but I do have something I'd like to add to your question earlier. I would hope that you might also consider as a top priority complete streets policies, because you can take advantage of monies that are already being spent day in and day out in terms of the transportation funding to try to move the ship of how our public rights of way are built so that they can serve all users of all ages and of all abilities. So my question to you is, have you evaluated in those communities that do have complete streets policies the potential effect on physical activity? Because that would also be very strengthening to those other communities that are considering complete streets policies to know that if you do this, this is the impact that you will have on physical activity.
Do you want to answer that?
Well, I think we're looking at it from the student perspective, and also we're also looking at what they've actually done around complete streets, and also what the grantees are reporting about what's happened. So we aren't actually going out and measuring bikeways or walking paths to see how many people are using them.
We are attempting to do that, but it's too soon for us to have any results because we haven't seen the changes actually take place. And I would also add that we have to do this better. This is one of the places where we have no evidence. So we assume that it works, and we develop strategies because it seems like it will work, but we don't have solid evaluations that tell us that it works.
Okay, well, thank you very much for being a great audience, and we'd like a hand for all of these great presenters, if we would. Thank you.